Did you know that according to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, the average drug on a pharmacy shelf took 12 years to get there? It's a true statistic. When a company sets out to develop a new medicine, a new drug, it will be 12 years of testing, of research, of laboratory research, of development, and that company will spend more than $350 million to get one medicine on the shelf. Only about 1 in 1,000 make it, and that's good. Because you need to know that when you open up that bottle of Tylenol or that bottle of ibuprofen, that it's safe to take. And you trust that it's safe to take, that it will perform as advertised. And you trust that because you know it's been tested. It's been put through a series of trials and a battery of tests and some experiments. And it's come through all of that and it has been approved. It's been tested and approved. And it's not just medicine. Almost every product you can buy in the store nowadays has gone through some kind of test, some kind of research, some kind of check to make sure that what you have is certified to do what it is that it says it will do, that it's the genuine article, that it's real. A few years ago, there was a man who had a couple of kids, and he noticed that they kept spilling their snack all over the floor. And he thought to himself, there must be a better way to do this. So he went to his garage and he designed a gyroscopically controlled bowl. And basically what the design was is a larger bowl with a smaller bowl inside. And so no matter how you tilt the outside bowl, that center bowl, that interior bowl stays upright and the food doesn't spill and the kids can play. And it was a great concept. And so he built a prototype. And he took it to a laboratory where it would be tested by kids in real life situations. And what he discovered was the kids didn't actually pick up that bowl from the outside, but rather they pinched it by the top edge and they kind of locked the two bowls together so that the one inside couldn't move, disabled the gyroscopic component, rendered the whole thing worthless. So he went back to the drawing board and he added a circular handle around the outside of that bowl. Gave it back to the kids. Now they pick it up by the handle, not by the edge. It worked perfectly. Parents love it. You can buy it. It's called the Gyro Bowl. It's online. It's in the stores. And it works exactly as it's advertised to work because it has been tested and approved. And when it comes to our faith, it's the same thing. We need to know that what we have is real. We need to know that our faith will perform as advertised. After all, it's what we're hanging eternity on. And we need to know that it will do what it says it will do. And one of the reasons we know it will is because it's been tested. It's been challenged. It's been investigated. It's been tested and approved. And that's what Peter focuses on as we come into the passage this morning. Because one of the things the world will do during a storm of persecution against the church is try to cast doubt on your faith, to cast doubt on the nature of God and the nature of Christ and the nature of His Word and the truth of your salvation. But it might not surprise you to hear it's not a new thing. It's been happening since almost the dawn of time. If you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, you find the very first temptation that Satan gave to Eve all the way back in the Garden of Eden was a temptation of doubt. He says in Genesis 3, "Did God actually say?" And there comes the doubt of God, the doubt of His word, the doubt of His law. And a couple of books later, in the book of Deuteronomy, God warns us of a time when the world will send in false prophets and false teachers and people bringing distraction into the church to draw it away from the one and only God. He says in Deuteronomy 13, "If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder that he tells you comes to pass, and if he says, 'Let us go after other gods which you have not known, and let us serve them,' you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer, for the Lord God is testing you." So it happened to Eve. It happened in the Old Testament. We have warnings of that in the Old Testament. It happened in the New Testament because the Pharisees and the legalists and the Romans and the pagan world doubted the deity of Jesus Christ. And it's happening in our culture today. Doubt is being cast on our faith. But I find it interesting that even though that storm of persecution is as strong as we have ever seen it, it's not a new attack. It's not a new argument. It's as old as time itself. It says in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 9, what has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. You see, this attack is not new. This storm of persecution is not new. And so when we come to this passage, Peter wants believers to know that your faith can be trusted. In spite of what the world says, despite what the world says, your faith has been tested and approved to be 100% genuine. Notice what he says as we come into 1 Peter verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. One of the reasons we know we can trust our faith is because it's permanent. It's not going anywhere. In other words, it is based on a permanent, unchanging God. When I was in high school, and those of you my age, you might remember this, but what was really fashionable were those Discman Walkmans. You remember those? And they were about yay big, and they took four AA batteries, and you could put them in your pocket if you had a big enough pocket, which was also the fashion. But then you would have these headphones, and I mean these monster headphones that made your head look like a raisin. They were just that big. And the more CDs you had, the more fashionable you were. So kids would carry around these binders, 3 inches thick, pages and pages and pages of CDs, and they would compare collections, and they would compare artists, and they would compare their Walkman and their headphones. And then the iPod came around. And all of a sudden, those collections were worthless. And no longer did you carry this binder of CDs, but now you had this little tiny gadget that you could just kind of put in your pocket, and these little tiny earbuds that could go up to your ear. And now kids were comparing colors and features. But even that's changed, because nowadays kids aren't comparing iPods, they're comparing cell phones and Facebook likes and social media rants, and all of these things are what kids are comparing against one another. And you know what? In 10 years, it'll be different again. The point is, our world is constantly changing. The things that we believe are important in culture are constantly on the move. But on the other hand, you have a God that is never changing at all. He says in Hebrews 13, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. One of the reasons you know you can trust your faith is because it's built on something that is not ever going to change. It's not built on something that'll be different tomorrow. It's built on the immovable permanence of the Creator of heaven and earth. Peter tells us in verse 4, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept or guarded or preserved in heaven for you. You see that word inheritance? If you wanted to really nerd this out, and I mean this is major geek time, what you would do is you would look at that in Greek, and you would see that it's actually referring to the promise that God made to Abraham all the way back in the book of Genesis in the 12th chapter, and how the promise was that he would give to Abraham's descendants the land of Canaan. The 12 tribes of Israel would inherit that land. He says in Genesis 12, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, to your offspring I will give this land. And so Peter brings that up here for a couple of reasons. First of all, Abraham and his descendants, they didn't do anything to earn that. They didn't win it. Militarily, every time they went into battle, every time they went to war, they were outmatched. They were outnumbered. They didn't deserve it. They didn't buy it. They didn't own it. This was a gift from God to them. This was an inheritance that they got simply by being children of the Most High. And second, they didn't do anything to preserve it. In fact, if you look through Israel's history, you'll find time and time and time again, Israel as a nation sins against God. They reject God. They bring in false teachers. They bring in false gods, false religion. And yet God still preserved that inheritance. He protected that. And so the idea here is that just like God preserved the promised land for them, that he'll do the same for you. You have an inheritance from God. As a believer, as a child of Christ, you have an inheritance. And just like nothing in this world can change that, nothing you do can lose that. It's permanent. It's protected. It's kept in heaven for you. I read a story this past week about one of the biggest bank robberies in history. It happened in Brazil in 2005, and it happened against one of the most secure banks in the nation at the time. And what happened was this group of bank robbers rented the building across the street from the bank. And for the next 3 months, they tunneled 256 feet underground, under the sidewalk, under the road, under the other sidewalk, under the foundation of the bank. And they measured and planned in such a way that when they came up through the floor, they were in the vault room. They made off with $70 million, most of which has never been recovered. Probably most of us would argue a bank is fairly safe. You can put your money there and trust it'll be there tomorrow. But nothing in this world is eternally safe. Jesus said in Matthew 6, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal." And Peter wants us to know that your inheritance from God is eternally secure, that it's protected, that it's guarded, that it's kept in heaven for you. And notice how he describes it in verse 4. He says, imperishable, undefiled, and unfading. And that's important to remember because when the world tries to come against your faith, it's coming with temporary things. It's coming with culture that we know changes on a whim. It's coming with popular opinion that changes with every social media post. It's coming with fashion that changes depending on what celebrity is making what statement at the time. But when that happens, and when we put it into perspective, what we realize is it's like shooting spitballs at a tank. It's sticky, it's gross, it's annoying. But at the end of the day, it doesn't have any real effect because what you have is permanent. What you have is guarded. You also have something that's progressing, something that's growing. You have a permanent faith, you have a progressing faith. Notice what Peter goes on to say in verse 6. In this you rejoice. In what you rejoice? Well, in the fact that your inheritance is preserved, we rejoice. Though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. Notice he says a little while. He doesn't say forever. Trials will come. Storms will come. But none of them last forever. All storms eventually settle. The storm in Texas settled. The storm in Florida dissipated and settled. Storms will come, but storms will pass. One of the things I used to tell people is there's no such thing as a bad Friday. And what I mean by that is you can have a hard Friday. It can be a difficult Friday. It might be a Friday you wish had never happened. But in less than 8 hours, it's over. And the weekend is right on its heels. And so I developed this philosophy that you can't have a bad Friday. And with that in mind, it was a lot easier to get through that day. And Peter says basically the same thing here. No matter what happens, don't let a temporary problem distract your focus from an eternal promise. Because even though that trial will come, and even though that storm will come, Peter reminds us it's for a little while. It will come and it will go, and you will persevere through it. And not only will you persevere, but after it's over, you'll be stronger for having experienced it. Your faith will be deeper. Your trust in God will be deeper, and you will be better because you went through that storm than if it had never happened at all. That's what Paul means when he says in Romans 8 that for those who love God, all things work together for the good. Not that all things are inherently good, but there is a good that can come out of any situation. For example, back in the early 90s, Hurricane Andrew ravaged Florida. And because of the damage and destruction of that storm, the building code was changed. And it required that the roofs of houses would be attached to the walls in a different way. That code was still in place when Hurricane Irma came through just last week. And because of that code, those houses survived. The damage wasn't as bad as it could have been. One pastor once said this, "Nothing ever happens to you. Everything happens for you." And it's the idea that no matter what happens in life, God doesn't allow anything to happen except that which will build you up, which will grow your faith. And I would say that some of the most faithful, most committed believers I have ever met are those who have been through the most, not the least. They're those who have faced the storm. They're those who have seen the trials and they've seen the persecution of the world. And they've come out of that temporary difficulty with a deeper faith, a higher praise, because they've grown. They've progressed in their faith. And so we have a permanent faith. We have a progressing faith. Third, we have a purified faith, because that storm isn't there for nothing. It has a purpose. Look at what Peter says in verse 7. "So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." I've always thought it is amazing how hardship has the ability to reveal the truth. You want to see what something's really made of? Put it to the test. And Peter says it's the same thing with gold. You see, during his time, gold was the most valuable thing in the world. The more gold a king had, for example, the more powerful he was considered. The more gold he had, the more he was feared, the more he was respected, the less likely he was to be invaded, which is very handy if you're a king. It was in jewelry, it was the money, it was your social status. The more gold you had, the more you had a social status in life. But even all of that considered, gold itself wasn't perfect. Because before it could be used, it had to be purified. It had to be melted down by a goldsmith. And the impurities were removed. It was tested by fire. And what you had after that process was more pure than what you had before. And so Peter says your faith works much the same way. It doesn't get stronger when times are easy. It gets stronger when it's put to the test. It gets stronger through the trials, through the furnace of life that melts away the impurities. Proverbs 17 says, "The crucible is for silver, the furnace is for gold, and the Lord has tested our hearts." I like what one commentator said on this passage. He said, "Gold and fire are both proved, or gold and faith are both proved by fire. Just as men used fire to distinguish true gold from counterfeit, so God uses trials to distinguish genuine faith from superficial profession." You remember the time when Jesus was with his disciples, and he said in John 15, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser, and any branch in me that bears fruit, he prunes so that it may bear more fruit." Well, you see, the analogy there is that a vine dresser needs that vine to be pure. He needs that vine to be effective. And so he examines each branch, and anything, any impurity, anything that doesn't produce, he prunes away. He cuts it away to get down to something very valuable. And Peter tells us it's the same thing with our faith, that the genuineness of our faith is what is left over after it's been tested. And so when we encounter hardship and we come to trials and we come to difficulty and trying times in the world, it isn't that God is trying to break us, but on the contrary, it's that God is trying to build us. He's purifying our faith. Psalm 66 says, "For you, O God, have tested us." You see, it's easy to be faithful when times are easy. But what about when the storm comes? And I ask that question because for the past 200 years in America, it's been pretty easy to be a believer. But it seems nowadays those winds have changed. And for the very first time in our nation's history, we're seeing outright hostility toward the church. Sunday is just another day for people, for a lot of people. There are groups who exist solely to lobby Congress to remove any trace of the Bible from public education. You know, the Bible used to be how they taught kids to read. And now there are groups lobbying to get it out of there. And I honestly think what we're seeing is a purifying of the church, that the genuine believers are remaining and that vine is being pruned. But I also think that it's always darkest before the dawn. And if you look back through church history, you will find that every major revival and every major revitalization of the church doesn't come when times are easy. It comes on the heels of a storm of persecution. I like what Joseph said in Genesis 50, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good that many people would be saved." So we have a purified faith. We have a faith that God is working on, a faith that he's building us up in. Fourth, we have a positive faith. And what I mean by that is it's an affirmative faith. It's a certain faith. Notice what he says in verse 8, "Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your soul." It might surprise you to hear that in Christian archaeology, more than 25,000 artifacts from the Old Testament have been discovered. Everything from weapons to clothing to jewelry to pottery to homes, you name it, it's there, 25,000 artifacts. One of the biggest finds in the history of archaeology, and not just Christian archaeology, but even secular archaeology, was a biblical city of Sodom. And what they're discovering is it was destroyed exactly the way the Bible said. It was a big fire, a big explosion, fire coming down from the sky, destroying the entire thing. 25,000 archaeological finds that prove the Old Testament. On the other hand, when we come to the New Testament, the last time I checked, there were about 130 or so archaeological finds. 25,000 from the Old Testament, 130 from the New. And that seems a bit different. The New Testament is more recent. We should have more from there than the Old Testament, but that's just not the way it worked out. It seems there is less proof of the Bible in the New Testament than the Old, even though the Old Testament is farther removed. And I would submit to you that even the lack of physical evidence serves to prove our faith. Because the people of the Old Testament, they lived under the law. They didn't need faith. They lived under rules and regulations, and they had the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, and they saw these things happen. They didn't have faith. They had the law. But when it comes to the New Testament, we don't live under the law, but we are called to walk in faith. And faith, by definition, doesn't rely on physical evidence. Hebrews 11 says, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." Paul tells us in Ephesians 2, "By grace you have been saved through faith." You see, without faith in God, it is impossible to have a relationship with God. And when the world wants to cast doubt on your faith by saying there's not enough proof for it, you know that it is the lack of proof itself that allows the faith to exist. And the same God that calls for the faith allows it to happen. You remember the time Jesus was speaking with Thomas after the resurrection, and Thomas, doubting Thomas, he became known as, said, "Unless I can touch the hole and put my finger in the wound and see it with my own eyes, I'm not going to believe." But Jesus said in John 20, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." There is a lack of physical evidence, but that's because there is a presence of faith. And a lack of physical evidence doesn't mean a lack of spiritual evidence. There's plenty of confirmation of your faith available. Think about the conviction you have, the sense of right from wrong, the desire to please God, the desire to grow in your faith, the spiritual gifts that you have, the guidance in your life, how you can look back on your life and you can see how the Holy Spirit had guided you around certain obstacles that would have been detrimental. So we have a permanent faith. We have a progressing faith, a purified faith. We have a positive faith. We are sure of what we believe. And finally, we have a proven faith. Notice what he goes on to say in verse 10. Concerning this salvation, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that was to be yours searched and inquired carefully, inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you, in the things that have now been announced to you through those who preach the good news to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. You ever thought about your faith as something the angels are jealous of? Peter tells us they long to look. Back in 2001, my grandfather shocked our entire family. And I mean, this is stop the press, let everyone know kind of huge news. It was something that had not been heard in 30 years. He was looking for a new car. My grandfather had been driving the same car since 1970, one of those Oldsmobile tanks. You know what I mean? The kind that it's as wide as it is long and things would break and he would just fix it and keep going. When Melissa and I started dating and we were first married back in 2007, he was still driving that same car. We took a ride in it to go see an Orioles baseball game down in Baltimore. It was a smooth ride, but he was looking for a new one. And so in 2001, he announced this was the time to upgrade. And so he started researching and he started investigating and he started looking into miles per gallon and safety ratings. And by the time 2007 came around, he had one he liked. The problem was they didn't make it anymore. So it was back to the drawing board, back to square one. He finally bought a new car in 2010. 10 years after he started his search, he found one. And we joked that if we ever needed a new car, we didn't have to bother looking into it because whatever one pop-up got, that car had more research done on it than probably the people who built the thing. We knew that one was good. It had been tested. It had been investigated. And Peter says, when it comes to your faith, you can trust it because the same thing has happened. It's been investigated. It's been researched. He says, searched and inquired carefully. You see, when the prophets got the revelation, they didn't just take it for granted. They checked it. And they checked it against the law. And they checked it against the world, and they checked it against other prophecy and other scripture, every jot and every tittle. And these are scholars of the law, unlike our world has ever seen. And they put it through that kind of ringer, and at the end of it, they came up with the conclusion that it was absolutely 100% right. And that's important to remember. Because another thing the world will tell you to try and cast doubt on your faith is that Christianity is just like all the others. That there's a lot of religions in the world. Everyone claims to worship God. Christianity just does it by a different name. But the Bible teaches us that that is absolutely untrue, because a faith in Jesus Christ is not like a religion to any other secular god. Jesus tells us in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. In Acts chapter 4, it says, there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. You can trust your faith because it's been tested. It's been investigated. It's been researched by the people who put it on paper, and they said this is absolutely correct. The world won't accept that, though, and we understand that. And even though it won't accept the truth of Christ, we as believers know that we have a faith that is built on something a lot stronger than anything of this world. It's built on the rock of truth of the Creator of heaven and earth, and it will withstand any storm. It can stand up to any persecution, and we can trust it to do exactly what it says it will do because it has been tested and approved.